Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest,
Coming up on the programme, it's seemingly come from nowhere to being one of the world's most devastating diseases in just a quarter of a century. As the 25th anniversary of the first case of HIV/AIDS approaches, Network Europe examines the efforts to raise awareness and hears from parts of Europe where stigmatisation is still a reality.
This is a country where people still are scared of touching someone with HIV. They think they're going to contract HIV by just touching someone.
We hear from our reporter in Brussels and a competition to find the best AIDS awareness TV advert. Warning, they all contain condoms. And with the French presidential election just a few months away, the front runners try some new tricks to win the top job. No condoms involved. These stories and more, including the answer to this month's quiz and the name of the lucky winner, in this edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters. I'm Richard Walker. Thanks for joining me. The statistics are extraordinary. 40 million people are living with HIV/AIDS around the world. 3 million people died this year, and another 4.3 million were newly infected. Earlier this week, these figures were released as part of the UN's annual census on the global fight against HIV and AIDS. Radio Netherlands spoke to Dutch AIDS ambassador Paul Beckers, who told us the positives and the problems highlighted in the report.
And let me start with the good news. The figures clearly indicate that people have increased access to effective treatment. So more people have access to ARVs.
Just quickly, what are ARVs?
Oh, that's antiretroviral treatment. So it's the medication people that are HIV positive. When it comes to a certain stage, you can indicate, well, now it is time for the person to take ARVs. And which means that the person will not develop AIDS. That's why, like in our countries, HIV is no longer a death sentence, but a chronic disease. The bad news is that, on the whole, the epidemic is still increasing. We're talking about 40 million people worldwide that are HIV positive. We have 4.3 new infections only in 2006. Altogether, there is a slight increase from the previous year.
Is there a global consensus on what needs to be done to tackle AIDS, or does it vary from country to country?
Well, what varies from country to country is first of all, the prevalence itself, so how many people are HIV infected, but also the commitment of governments. Some are more committed have put it much higher on agenda, make many more funds available for the fight against HIV/AIDS. But the problems are also, to respond to your question, different per country. If we look at Eastern Europe and Central Asia, where we saw the strongest increase of the numbers of people HIV infected over the past year, more than in Southern Africa, that is mainly due by intravenous drug use. So people use dirty syringes, and that's how they get infected. Now, that requires, of course, a different approach to actually tackle HIV, to fight HIV.
Radio Netherlands' Marnie Chesterton speaking to Dutch AIDS ambassador Paul Beckers for Network Europe there. Now, ever since the first mysterious reports of the disease, fear, denial and stigma have accompanied the AIDS epidemic. And in many countries around the world, the disease is closely associated with discrimination. Individuals affected by HIV have been rejected by their families, their friends and their communities. In Cyprus, the official number with HIV is around 500, but AIDS support groups estimate the figure is four times that. A significant figure for an island of less than a million people where everybody knows each other. The Cypriot in the street seems to believe AIDS isn't a problem. But as Deutsche Welle reporter Barbara Gruber found out, prejudice isn't far beneath the surface.
From talking to the people on the streets here in Cyprus, AIDS doesn't seem to be much of an issue.
I don't think there's many people in Cyprus with AIDS. I don't know, 50 out of 100,
I don't think that many people have AIDS in Cyprus, or they just don't show it, or they just don't tell it. And there's no discrimination, I think.
But 37-year-old Nikos tells a different story.
It's like you're living in prison. Everything is a window dressing here. I've been living with HIV for 10 years now. Things haven't changed. Things are all the same in every aspect. People try to put down my IQ. This is a country where people still are scared of touching someone with HIV. They think they're going to contract HIV by just touching someone. And it's so sad because I know how things can be different.
Nikos, who doesn't want to give his real name, spends most of his time locked up in his tiny apartment in Nicosia, taking his mind off his situation by listening to music and painting. This small man with an outgoing personality would love to get out more, maybe join a gym, but doesn't have enough money. Although he got a BA and MBA in England, he can't find steady work. The 400 euros he gets from the government barely cover his rent and his basic needs. But he says he doesn't want to judge or criticize people. He just wants his dignity.
People, they don't know what's the difference between HIV and AIDS. You know how hard time I had when I was making my application for the house? In all government offices, I was telling them I've been HIV, and they were asking me, what is this? What is this? I couldn't tell them AIDS. I couldn't, because AIDS means gay, means bad person, means filthy person, means punishment by God, means all those things in Cyprus. That's why I lock myself in my house. I try to do things for myself. I run marathons. I run marathons for myself. I do things to get the stress out of me, to all this power outside, because I have anger, I'm angry.
Ένα σου πω να σας δώσω μια κορδέλα που θα σου δείξει λιγότερο. Να βγούμε τα παλιά μας κοτσούθια.
5 years ago, there were no places for people who are HIV positive or suffering from AIDS to turn for help.
We are a conservative society in Cyprus. Imagine if they stigmatize a homosexual, how they behave to a person that is HIV.
That's Stella Michaelidis, chairwoman of the AIDS support group KIFA. She opened the first support center with money she raised herself. People can come here for a chat, to have coffee or speak to a psychologist. Like George, who was infected with HIV more than 10 years ago. He comes here almost every day, he tells me with a broad smile.
KIFA has supported me a lot of times, financially, mentally, and psychologically. Loneliness is the main problem I'm facing every day. The most important thing to me is that people accept us and don't treat us as if we're aliens.
Despite the loneliness, people with HIV/AIDS are often too afraid to meet each other, says volunteer Stella Michaelidis.
I tried to get them together last year. And I ask through the newspapers also to come to KIFA and this and that. They don't want to know each other because it's a close community. They are afraid.
Some are even afraid of registering to get the free medicine they are entitled to in Cyprus, says AIDS activist Stella Michaelidis. Those who can afford it often go abroad for treatment and medicine. The fear of stigma and discrimination is huge, especially at the only AIDS clinic in Cyprus, confirms Nikos.
The clinic is a mixed clinic. There are people with other illnesses, and they're thinking that by doing this, they're going to protect the name of the people. But I couldn't get my pills for 2 months lately because there was a lady, an aunt of mine, actually with heart problems, that was actually in the clinic, and I couldn't go there.
People are afraid of losing their jobs, their apartments, and their friends. Society is so small and conservative in Cyprus. It's very difficult to find work once rumors are going around that someone has HIV.
We had an incident this year. A woman was fired from her job twice because they found out that she was HIV positive. Of course, they didn't give the excuse that she's HIV and they found it out. They found another excuse.
The energetic president of KIFA is one of the few people to openly speak about AIDS in Cyprus. She says there's still a long way to go. People with HIV and AIDS need to get paid monthly benefits that allow them to live a dignified life. New medications have to be made available. An HIV test result should be back in 5 days and not 5 months, says Stella Michaelidis. But one of the most important things in her eyes is getting a proper hospice for people suffering from HIV/AIDS. For 10 years now, she has been trying to make that happen.
This year, we have an improvement. They gave us a piece of land to build a hospice. This is a project that we have, and we are trying to do it. Now we are fighting to make this hospice. Of course, we will need £500,000 to do that. I believe that we will find the money. This is a very big step for the government to give us a piece of land to build this hospice.
At the same time, she warns the virus is on the rise. Increased drug abuse and ever less precautions are all contributing to spread the virus, while prejudice and discrimination are killing HIV sufferers. For Nikos, it's not so much the disease anymore that is making his life unbearable. It's the rejection he experiences every day.
We don't belong anywhere. We are not even special needs people. I have to take about 10, 12 pills a day. It's not the disease that will kill me one day. It's the side effects of the disease, and I know that. Death doesn't scare me. It's the quality of today. It's my dignity that counts.
Barbara Gruber, Deutsche Welle Radio, Cyprus.
And coming up later on Network Europe, French presidential hopefuls do the unthinkable and start listening to people.
Let's hear what the people have to say. The candidates will tell you that that contact on a daily basis in a very intense situation with people who are asking difficult questions is very, very informative.
Now, many people still suffer from the stigma attached to the HIV/AIDS virus, although some efforts to educate have been successful. 14 years ago, Amsterdam hosted the International AIDS Conference in the ongoing effort to debunk the myths surrounding the virus. Radio Netherlands caught up with two of the men behind what has now become the world's famous symbol of AIDS awareness, the red ribbon. Andrew Butterfield and Roger Lawley told Radio Netherlands what they wanted the ribbon to do.
We hope that it will become a symbol for teaching children a very simple message about AIDS and the prevention of AIDS and HIV.
What are you actually saying through wearing a red ribbon? I mean, what is the overall message?
The message is that the red ribbon is a worldwide badge, a symbol, an emblem of AIDS awareness, an educative tool, if you'd like. Young and old can wear it, rich or poor. It could be worn just as well by the Queen Juliana of the Netherlands or somebody who sweeps the street. It has the same message across the board. The campaign itself is global. We would hope that the symbol would become globally accepted. Andrew said that when he first started to do this, his aim was that this should become a symbol for the world, for people to unite in their battle against the onslaught of AIDS and HIV.
Andy, tell me about your impressions of this conference so far.
The impression has been quite overwhelming in many respects, because the title of the conference is To Fight AIDS, We Have to Fight Together. And when we produce and present the idea, if we can have to fight a battle or to unite against something, you cannot unite unless you have a symbol to unite under. And when we present that to people from the widest cross-section, from Malaysia to depths of Africa, people go, yes, it's quite obvious that we need a symbol that represents that unity in fighting AIDS.
Would you also say that by incorporating sort of popular culture into a campaign like Red Ribbon, that again the message will be further sort of hit home?
Particularly with music. Most young people in Eastern Europe, if they are not too successful at learning, say, English or French in school, they tend to learn a lot of their language to get a grip on it, a grasp of it, from movies, from popular songs. And in this way, popular culture can help to reach, to stretch that message of AIDS awareness. We have been in Scotland and England with the band Erasure, and we hope to tour with them through Scandinavia and Eastern Europe. And at each of their concerts, when you have an audience of 4,000 or 5,000 young people, in Scotland particularly, we gave away the red ribbon with condoms at each venue, and they were very, very popular. People don't snigger, particularly in Edinburgh. They knew exactly what the symbol was about.
If I could ask you to sum up, or perhaps come up with a statement to go with the wearing of a red ribbon?
This statement we have at the bottom of the pamphlet which we're distributing in Amsterdam, wear the ribbon, unite in the fight against AIDS. That's a simple message. Many people who wear the ribbon may be aware themselves of the dangers or the need for education, but somebody who sees it on the street will get a subtle little jog to their memory, and that will help.
And indeed, it did become a symbol, because the red ribbon has gone on to represent AIDS awareness campaigns in Europe and beyond. Now, governments vary a lot in their commitment to the fight against the disease, and one country with a real drive to combat AIDS is Sweden. Sweden's designated the fight against HIV/AIDS as a central focus of its development aid policy, and it's put a lot of money into prevention in developing countries. But coordinating these prevention efforts is often inefficient, and money gets wasted. Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros sent Network Europe this report.
Traditions and customs have proved major obstacles in the struggle against HIV/AIDS. In some countries, girls as young as 10 are given in marriage to men who are old enough to be their grandfathers. These men continue to have sexual relations with other women, some of them HIV victims. Adrienne Germain is the president of the International Women's Health Coalition in the United States.
We must mobilize to educate and inform our young people, to help them treat each other differently with respect, to end violence by men against girls and women, and to reduce the risk, therefore, that girls and women have.
There has been a heated debate among the non-government organizations involved in the fight against HIV/AIDS about the priorities. Some civic and religious organizations in the United States and other countries, supported by the Bush administration, have been advocating sexual abstinence among young people, while other organizations argue that those who suffer most have not been benefiting from the available treatment and medication. But Sweden's ambassador against HIV/AIDS, Lennart Jelmoka, says both approaches are needed.
We must and we should view prevention and treatment as supporting each other and do it hand in hand, so to say. We do not talk about prevention or treatment. We need both. We should do whatever we can to help people also in poor countries to receive treatment if they are infected and if they have developed AIDS. But to be able to live up to that promise, because there is an international promise now on universal access, and to live up to that promise that the world leaders have agreed upon, that we should provide universal access on treatment also, it is critical that we can halt the spread of the infection, that in the future we cannot see 4 more million infections per year.
Adrienne Germain is convinced that the fight against HIV/AIDS in the developing countries will not bear much fruit unless women are equally empowered as men. Men have the necessary contraceptives to protect themselves, but women are left vulnerable simply because the pharmaceutical industry and the international community have not paid any attention to the need to provide women with their own contraceptives. But there is light at the end of the tunnel. Adrienne Germain, a president of the International Women's Health Coalition in the United States, says efforts are being made to develop different types of female contraceptives.
It's a product or range of products like a contraceptive foam or jelly or cream that women would use, that they could insert in the vagina without men knowing, that would be effective against the HIV virus and protect them and their partner. It's called microbicides. There are 4 products in the final stage of clinical trials now. These are funded at the level of $160 million a year only. We need to double that amount every year for the next 4 years only to complete that research. And in that time, if we could have just that much more money, which is not really very much compared to, say, the vaccine investment, then we will know if microbicides are a feasible and possible technology for women.
Now, as a regular feature on Network Europe, we talk to our esteemed Brussels correspondent, Stephen Castle. And this being an AIDS-themed programme, when I spoke to him a short while ago, I asked him if the arms of European government had any AIDS initiatives of their own. Not surprisingly, they have, and one of the most novel is a competition pitting TV public awareness campaign adverts against each other.
What's going to happen? There's going to be a big night in a cinema in Brussels. There's going to be a website. In fact, the website's already up and running. People can vote for their favourite AIDS awareness ads. And already there's some rather good entries. There's one which, in fact, comes from the Netherlands, which features a variety of scenes in which either a man or a woman is trying to introduce the idea of a condom into the conversation. And it shows a number of scenes where this has been done slightly too soon and it goes down extremely badly as a chat-up line, or it's been done too late, and there's one scene there with a woman who's clearly pregnant at the altar.
Are they in general quite humorous, these ads, or do you see some serious ones too?
They're a combination. That's on the more humorous level. There are one or two slightly more scary ads that illustrate the number of people that are contracting HIV, which of course is rising across the EU and is alarming the officials in Brussels, particularly countries in Eastern Europe. The former Soviet countries of the Baltic states have very high incidence. But across the EU, the incidence of HIV infection is increasing in almost every country, and what officials here fear is that there's a new generation coming along all the time, becoming sexually active, and these messages need to be repeated constantly.
Moving swiftly on to serious business around Europe, the Dutch election produced another very divided result, didn't it? No clear winner there, and this is quite typical of elections around Europe at the moment, isn't it?
That's right. Voters seem to be finding a great deal of difficulty in choosing between the different political parties on offer to them. We saw this trend in Germany, where Angela Merkel had to struggle to put together her government, and in Italy, where Romano Prodi just scraped in again. In Sweden, the voters were more or less divided too, and we're expecting an extremely close contest in France, which holds presidential elections next year. For the EU, this presents some problems. There's not a lot of political leadership around. Everybody, of course, here is waiting for the outcome of that presidential election in France. And really nothing on the big fundamental political issues in the EU can really be addressed until we know the result of that election. And in particular, here, I'm thinking about the fate of the European Constitution.
Particularly relevant to Holland again, I suppose, since they were one of the two countries who rejected it.
Well, that's precisely the case. And the fear is that if this is a rather weak government in the Netherlands, if it's trying to bolt together a whole variety of different opinions, it will find it very difficult to take a clear position on the European Constitution and on what should now happen. And as you say, the Netherlands is one of the two countries that really needs to be brought on board with any solution very urgently.
Thanks a lot to our Brussels correspondent, Stephen Castle. And you heard Stephen mention there how important the result of the French presidential election next year will be to the future of the EU. Well, the race to win that presidency is already underway in earnest. The two main candidates, socialist media darling Ségolène Royal and her right-wing rival Nicolas Sarkozy, have both been tapping opinion on the streets of France for ideas. It's an American way of doing things in what's shaping into an American-style campaign. Logically, then, Radio France International's Nick Champeau went to find out who out of Royal and Sarkozy is the most American.
Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Does that ring a bell? President John Fitzgerald Kennedy's inaugural address, 1961. Pretty obvious. But you also get points if you said Ségolène Royal, Mel Town Hall, Poitou-Charentes, France, 17th of November 2006. Following her landslide victory, Royal said she would carry on her participatory campaign. Get together and ask what you can do for your country, she said. wearing her trademark white suit, Royale called on every French citizen who has proposals to make for France to get in touch with her team, because citizens, she believes, are the best experts. Joseph Small Hoover is president of the French branch of the Democrats Abroad organization. He says Royale's strategy is very American.
We've seen in the Socialist Party over the last few months an enormous push to get new members, broadening the base, and now going out and saying, you know, we're going to talk to the people. Sounds like town meetings, a la Clinton, for instance, and the way that lots of other politicians in the United States, particularly on the Democratic side, but also on the Republican side, have been going for years. Let's hear what the people have to say. The candidates will tell you that contact on a daily basis in a very intense situation with people who are asking difficult questions is very, very informative.
In the meantime, citizens are also flattered. They feel important again.
Absolutely. Having someone of a national stature come by and wants to hear what you have to say and isn't simply going to give you the answer, that's a real big difference.
Royale's main rival, Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy, is also enthusiastic about the U.S. Although his command of the English language is not very good, he has made several trips to Washington as Interior and Finance Minister. Sarkozy has organized U.S.-style multi-million euro rallies. He has also hired people from the Boston Consultancy Group to help his UMP party organize efficient brainstorming sessions.
He's been doing focus groups. He's been approaching it from a very, well, not that they're not professional politicians, but a much more professional, much more organized, a very, in a certain sense, very scientific way. Looking at the opinion polls, seeing what people are really worried about, and then also being very careful to scientifically, it would appear, approach the media.
And that's American.
Absolutely. I think some of the best American politicians know very well how to use the media to their own advantage. I'm not saying that that's a good thing, but if you know how to make sure that you're on the front page of the paper every day, if you know how to make sure that you're on the first two to 5 minutes of the evening news at 8 o'clock, that will help you keep you in the mind of the voters. Hopefully positively, not always, but as they say, any publicity is better than no publicity whatsoever.
Ségolène Royal is also a media-savvy politician who certainly knows how to smile whenever cameras are around. Now, are there any U.S. politicians who can be affiliated to Sarkozy or Royal? Joseph Small Hoover isn't too sure about Sarkozy, but he says Hillary Clinton, Bill's wife, and Ségolène Royal, the partner of the Socialist Party Secretary General François Hollande, have a lot in common.
Both of them have, as life companions, a very powerful political figure who, in their own right. Both of them are clearly independent-thinking women. Both of them are women, which is a novelty in both societies. On policy grounds, I think it's way too early to talk about that, but there is one thing that I think is key for both of them, and that is they don't necessarily toe the party line. Hillary Clinton, she's not a big L liberal at all. She's an independent thinker. Ségolène Royal is doing very much the same thing, a revolution. She hasn't said that she won't respect the Socialist Party's platform, but she has said that we should go out and listen to the people to hear what they have to say as possible solutions for the problems. Well, that kind of says to me, well, we did this platform, it's really nice, but it's a platform.
Joseph Small Hoover, president of the French branch of the Democrats Abroad organization. Royale is the first ever woman presidential candidate who has a strong chance of winning the election in France. Unlike Sarkozy, she recently made the front page of Time magazine. But being too American can have downfalls. When Sarkozy had his picture taken with U.S. President George W. Bush last September, he may have actually lost votes. Paris, Nick Champeau, RFI.
Oh dear, we're near the end of the programme now, but of course I can't let you go without giving you the answer to this month's quiz. Just to remind you, the question was, how many Olympic swimming pools would the EU's wine lake fill? The answer's 16,000. Incredible, I know, but somebody's got to drink it. In fact, I know a man who'll give that a go. No, actually, I'm told it's being turned into bioethanol, whatever that is. Anyway, the winning answer chosen at random is from Elamir Gattas from Tallahassee, Florida in the USA. I'll try to get some of that quality European vino off to you soon, Elamir. That's all we've got time for today. This programme is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will be back next week. On behalf of our pan-European team, this is Richard Walker. Thanks a lot for joining us. How can I explain when words get